Okay, we're going to be starting on camera roll 152. We're going to be interviewing Mrs. Pat, mother of Lori Coyle. Okay, this is sound roll number 72 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm production. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, we're now going to be starting on camera roll. We're going to be interviewing Mrs. Pat, mother of Lori Coyle. We'll be starting with take number one. Here we go.
Speed.
Rolling.
This is Dorothy Coyle, take one, marker.
Dorothy, we're talking about stuff that happened a long time ago in the 60s. At some point, you were living a normal life, and you heard or you read in the newspapers, or you somehow came to your attention that there was a strike going on in Delano, and that there was a boycott. Do you remember how you first responded to that?
Oh, yes, I do. It was a natural response that we would support the boycott, we would support the strike. There was never a moment of doubt about it, debate about it.
Was there some, I mean, what was it about the farm workers' situation or what you had learned that really connected with? Why would you support that as opposed to any other, quote, cause?
Well, basically, the initial support came through my support for labor in general, and that does go back to school days and to my work days after school, and to a general sympathy towards the working people and towards unionism. But specifically concerning the farm workers' movement, I think several things. First of all, I really resented an attitude that I observed amongst many people who were not supporting the boycott, certainly not all of them, but many, that, oh, well, these are Mexicans. They are used to stoop labor. They are used to poverty. They are fortunate they are working in this country, not fully seeing the need for their support. Perhaps another personal impetus was the fact that as the daughter of Irish immigrants who knew full well what it was to dig potatoes out of the hard earth of Connacht in Western Ireland, and who knew what it was to watch as 3 million Irish men, women, and children died or left Ireland during the years of the Great Famines, during which time beef and corn were being shipped to England. I really personally am offended by exploitation. I find it particularly offensive.
I mean, did the farm workers' struggle was also...
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Can you try yourself a little,
darling? Yeah. Oh,
that's
right.
Yeah, this is going on. Excuse me.
Okay, that was take one. Take two's next.
Yeah, camera cuts for sound.
Are
you going to cut
for picture, Doug?
All right.
Okay, I'm ready.
Speed.
Rolling.
Speed. Rolling.
This is take two, marker.
I mean, unlike other labor situations, the farm workers was sort of an extreme situation. It was sort of characterized as David versus Goliath. These were people mm-hmm. who really needed help. Was that important to you, as opposed to seeing a strike somewhere? Did you sense that this was a real special case?
Yes, of course it was. I had read through the early 60s about the migrant workers and the plight of the migrant workers throughout the whole Southwest, and perhaps particularly in California. So I was not ignorant of the conditions in which they worked. And what I found particularly appealing, if you will, or of particular concern for all of us was the fact that these people were helping to put food on our tables, you know, a basic need of life. We all eat, and it seemed to me simply a matter of playing fair that I didn't feel people should suffer needlessly or live in often horrendous situations, conditions, in order to feed us grapes.
So it doesn't sound like, it sounded like the issues were pretty clear cut for you. It wasn't a decision you had to agonize over before.
Never, not at all.
When you made that decision, for example, you had a family, you had children, so part of it is you explained it. Do you remember having discussions with your kids? How did you explain it to them?
I don't recall specifically, but I do know that whatever I supported as far as whatever we purchased, whatever was served, was something that was accepted by the family. And the children did understand the rationale behind why we were supporting the strike.
I know in my case, I still find it very hard to buy grapes. It's like a habit that you can't break. Once the contracts were signed, was the forbidden fruit back on the table?
Yes, it was. It was for a while. And then as the boycott was reinitiated.
I forgot to mention one thing before I started. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Normally, none of my...
Okay, that was take two. Take three is next.
This is take three, Marker.
I want to switch gears for a second, though. I think Lori told me, or maybe you told me when we talked, that supporting the boycott was not something you do in a group. It's like a personal decision. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
I need you to say the boycott is a personal decision. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I think I remember now. Yes, from the very beginning, supporting the boycott was a personal decision. It was not made as a communal decision, but it was clear within our family, and it was certainly clear to me, that what we were going for was an accumulation of effect, that the individual suffering of a person not being able to eat table grapes, which are delicious, sweet, juicy, you know, we miss them, okay? We miss them. We lived without them. This is not a huge problem on one level in California where you can pick up a cherry or an apricot or a peach. So that the degree of suffering was really not the important thing involved. The important thing involved was we were acting in community and we were pushing for an accumulation of effect, which it took a number of years to accomplish and finally bring about, I think, you know, about 12% of the people actually finally supported it. So that it was an individual plus individual type of thing to me.
Now let's switch gears and talk a little bit. You mentioned some early influences and that in fact these were ideas that were introduced to you in school that mm-hmm. you acted on.
Yes. Oh, well, when I attended college, we read social Catholic philosophers, and their ideas about the humanity of men and the rights of men were rooted firmly in the democratic ideal. That we all share the same, or should share the same political rights, the same social rights. And it was from that that all their thinking concerning labor evolved. There was an interesting comment made by Maritain, one of them, concerning those who did not support labor. He called them heretics, which is a term generally saved for those who break away from faith, who move off.
Serious differences.
Serious differences from whatever faith they belong to. If you break from that, you are a heretic. His point was that if you didn't fully support the democratic ideal with your full heart, with your personal conviction, you were a heretic. You were a lay heretic. So that, for example, if you could eat grapes during the time that a grape boycott was on, you were not fully supporting the democratic ideal. It was simple as that, but it was as commanding and demanding as that.
Now, you're a Catholic. You learned Catholic religious teachings. The other way these things came together was that the farm workers' movement had a deep religious base, too.
Yes.
Did that resonate with you when you learned that it had a religious...
Well, of course, we all saw the pictures of Caesar and the United Farm Workers attending Mass and receiving communion in the fields. And so there was that connection always between certainly Caesar as the leader and the Catholic faith. But I cannot say that it was because this was a group of Catholics who were involved in a labor activity that influenced me at all.
But let me put it this way. As a Catholic, as a Catholic who supported social teachings, it must have pleased you to see them being carried out, to see religion being used in such a positive way, didn't it?
I cannot honestly say that's how I looked at it. I did not look upon the activities of the United Farm Workers as Catholics acting out their beliefs as Catholics. I saw them as suffering workers demanding their rights. And for me, that was rooted in two things. Their basic humanity, which indeed was taught by the church through the popes, through those two basic labor encyclicals, and through those social philosophers who based their teaching on democracy. The full participation in democracy meant this is what you support. You support the freedom of laborers to live a decent life. So that I can't say there was a direct connection in my mind ever with this was a Catholic movement.
Okay, let's cut for a second. How much is on this magazine?
150 more.
Yeah, that's sort of like Kennedy was a
president because of certain values, not because he was a Catholic president.
Take three. Take four is next.
Take four. Marker.
I mean, the question in general is apart from not buying grapes, there were other ways in which your family's path crossed the farm worker's family, and there were other connections. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, my husband, who was a physician, went down during the summers of the late 1960s years down to Delano. Where he worked in a converted mobile home, had been converted into a clinic. And in that clinic, he provided medical care during his vacation time for the families, for the workers themselves, and for their families. And he was committed to that, and he was happy to participate in the work that was being done there. He did get to know and to like and admire Cesar Chavez, and he particularly enjoyed working with the migrant workers themselves. It was very obvious to Jim what he was providing for them. He enjoyed that kind of clinical medicine within families, and he did not in his professional life have the opportunity to do that. So it was certainly professionally very interesting to him. But certainly beyond that, he was contributing to the care of the farm workers, and he knew that and was, I think, proud and happy to do that.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been taking a vacation, but he was doing good work.
He could have been taking a vacation.
Yeah. Yes. And he took some of your children out too?
He took several of our children down at different times, Anne and Pat and Chris, and several of them went down a few times with him, and it was an experience for them.
Okay, hang on for a second. I think we're up.
We've run out of
medicine. We have these short pieces of film.
So all right.
Change to the second one.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 152. 153 will be next. Our next take will be take five.
Rolling.
This is take five. Marker.
Tell me that story that you were just telling me about your son when he went down with his father. He took a friend along. What happened?
Yes, well, my son Chris and my daughter Anne both went down several times. And on one of those occasions, Chris brought along a neighbor friend, Lee. And the children were able to see their dad working within the clinic itself in the mobile home and could see him doing all kinds of things that they had never seen dad do before, including telling the patients to dig in a box of old glasses to find eyeglasses, that things he had saved up that he knew they would not have access to it. And Lee was so impressed by the care Dr. Coyle was giving so generously to the United Farm Workers and was so taken with what he had accomplished that it was a big part of his becoming a doctor, he has told us.
Mm-hmm. That must feel really nice.
Yes, of course it is.
You know, when I worked for the union, my daughter was 7 at the time, and I took her around, and people criticized me. They said children should live sheltered lives. They shouldn't be exposed to difficult things. How did you feel about your kids seeing that part of the world that they didn't normally see?
oh, that seemed perfectly natural to me that my children would see that part of the world. And had Jim or the children not been interested, I would have wanted them to see it. We did live middle class, very comfortable lives. We were in our little Catholic middle class ghetto, if you will. And of course it's healthy for children to see people who live in different circumstances who do not have all the things that they have. So it was really a positive experience. And they enjoyed it, if that's the right word. I mean, they certainly learned a lot, and they were proud of their dad.
After, you know, the farm workers movement was very strong in the 60s and 70s, and then it faded from the public consciousness. There are still migrants out there, and they're still living horrible lives. Why do you think people stopped caring, or did they stop caring?
Well, you know, even at the height of the success of the boycott, there are only 12% of the consumers throughout the country even that supported it. So I think we tend to stay asleep, stay in our own cubbyholes, wrapped up in our own individual lives and our own needs. And we really need to be awakened by particular leaders who will, you know, lead the charge, who will show us ways in which we can act outside of ourselves, beyond our own needs. So that I think after the heyday of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, and after the contracts were initially assigned, they went off the front pages, they went out of our minds, we did start to eat grapes. I think we are due and overdue for some shock treatment again. I really do think that the needs of the farm workers are in the back of our minds, if they're there at all. And there is not that in-your-face kind of publicity, if you will, awareness amongst the average person. And it is the, you know, the average person, the middle-class people, the working people, who are eating the grapes, who need to be told. You know, if you believe in your whole heart, as you say you do, in this democratic charter, you can't. You simply can't. It's simple, but it's demanding. You support the boycott if you say you support the democratic ideal.
Seems pretty clear. The other thing we're trying to figure out with this film, looking back, is do you think that experience, do you think when Chavez woke the country up to the plight of farm workers, and when they, do you think that changed America at all? Are we a different country because of that?
I would certainly like to think that we're a different country because of Cesar Chavez, but I am not convinced that we are. I think in recent years, certainly, if anything, there is a growing negative attitude towards Mexican workers, indeed towards Mexican immigration and the whole question of illegal immigration. And that's being caught up in this whole thing about Mexican workers and what they contribute and how they should be treated and how they need not be treated. And they really are two separate and distinct questions. But I think in the mind of the average person, certainly in the political atmosphere in California today, it's not on the front burner at all. I don't know whether it's on the stove even at all.
And it's funny, too, because it's sort of, it has this circular thing. It's the same things that people were saying when they wouldn't support the boycott, now they're saying again even louder. It seems like those issues have come back.
Yes. Well, since the years of the boycott, of course, the boycott and went on during the late 60s, you know, the decade of turmoil and ferment and civil rights movements and beginnings, perhaps later on, of the women's movement, and there was this whole uprising of people demanding rights. And then we moved into a different decade, different times in which we became in our personal cocoons again, if you will, and we're considering our own needs and only our own needs. And these are protective devices that we all use, and I would think that to some degree it's cyclical. And to some degree, it's connected with the condition of the economy at any given time. So that if your economy is being pushed and there is a shortage of jobs for people who are not highly skilled, it's the old case of low man on the totem pole. And once again, You know, I think Mexican workers are considered low men on the totem pole and not really of a major concern to the average Californian at all. Perhaps it's time for marching with our banners again. There's the whole problem of the danger of pesticides in the fields. And, you know, how much is that being considered? How much is being done about that? So that perhaps we need another, some more shock troops.
Let's stop. I'm happy. If you don't have anything to add, do you have any other?
Okay, that was take five. I think it may be at room tone here. Hold on.
It'll have to be.
Okay, this is room tone for the interview with Dorothy Coyle.
Be quiet, please.
Okay, let's roll again and find out the real truth about Lori.
Okay.
Do we have enough film? Do we have enough film?
That okay, that was
not,
room tone.
I have,
and that's the end of the interview with Dorothy Coyle. Okay, this is sound rule number 74 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Production. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow in the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, we're now at La Paz, and this is going to be some wild track of early morning sounds. It's the quietest we've ever heard it here, so we'll see how much we can get. Here we go. Okay, let's try again. Okay, then we'll stop with the plane coming in.
Paul Chavez, take one. Marker.
Paul, as you were growing up and your dad was out organizing, what do you recall from that period? Did you spend time together? Did you go out together?
You know, there was a number of different periods, right, that I remember, but I guess some of the earliest ones were before the grape strike, when he was going around talking to people just about the idea of having a union and what people's lives would be like after there was a union. And what I remember was that there was a lot of trips. I remember we were always with my father. He was always on the road, and I remember trips to numerous funerals, and he would talk to people. And I remember that when he needed to do some leafleting, he would organize my older brothers and sisters, and I think I was the youngest one in the family that got to go along, and cousins and friends. And he basically had an army of kids that went out, and we leafleted the Central Valley with leaflets probably 3 or 4 times. So I can remember some of those trips where we stayed in people's homes and people fed us, and then my father would leave us on the corner of streets and in pairs, and we would leaflet, and he would pick us up at the end, and I remember his encouragement, right? Because you remember, we're all pretty young, right? And the big reward was always the raspadas, the snow cones at the end of the day. Yeah, but those are the kind of things I remember. I guess what I remember is that my father always found a way, probably out of necessity, to involve us in his work. The movement was big enough to include not only the work he had to do with workers, but there was also a role for the family and the kids to play.
Stop for a minute.
Train.
Okay, that was take one for the interview with Paul Chavez. If I didn't say before, we're on camera roll 154. And take two will be next, after the train leaves.
Rolling.
This is take two, marker.
You mentioned that, you know, your father included you in a lot of things, you know, when you went out and leaflet. Did you feel that you were able, because of that, to be close to your dad?
You know, at the risk of sounding cliche-ish, right? There wasn't a whole lot of time, but you know, I think that as you talk to people that knew my father, I know that as I've done that, especially since his passing, everybody had these really touching stories about how they felt that my father had known them personally, and which he did in many cases, but that how he touched them personally. I think my father had a real gift for when he spoke to you, giving himself completely. And so he did that. So while we may not have had a whole lot of time with him, when we were with him, he was able to basically give himself fully to whether it was a consejo that he was giving you or just listening to you cry and ask for help, you know. So he was real good about that. He had a way of really being able to just to turn himself over to you when you needed to talk to him.
Now, your father included your mother in major decisions. I mean, was your mother the kind of person that would say, oh, yes to everything, or was your attention there?
My mother, while a very private person, has some very strong opinions about what's right and wrong. And I know that on many occasions, she would speak up and she would let my father know what was on her mind. I think that's part of who she was, and I think that's kind of what attracted my father to her. I think that, you know, many times people with a lot of responsibility sometimes get a lot of folks around them that can say yes to things. And I think that my mother was a real healthy influence on my father, and I think that many times she would give him a point of view that other folks couldn't or wouldn't.
Were there rough times that you saw that your family was, you know, dad left CSO and started up a union, did a lot, you know, went through a lot of heavy decisions. Did you see that it weighed heavily on your mother?
You know, I would have to say that my mother was really the bedrock of the union, and of course our family in the early years, and even now. You know, my father was gone. He was gone a lot. And so my mother basically raised eight of us. But let me give an idea of some of the sacrifices she made. See, she worked in the fields to feed the family, because when my father first started organizing, there was no income. So she single-handedly went out and she worked and she earned money to feed the family. And the money that was left over, she gave to my father for gas. And so that's the kind of commitment that my mother made, the sacrifices she made. I think like any mother, she probably wanted her kids to have new shoes and when Easter come, have nice Easter clothes, right? She sacrificed that because she knew that my dad's work was important.
Okay. Now, in 1971, the whole union moved to La Paz. What do you think was behind that? What was going on, do you think, in your father's mind? Did he have to get away, or why was that?
You know, I think what happened was that, see, my father always had his dream always was always that of a national union for farm workers. Of course, you know, we know that the largest concentration of farm workers are here in California, but he knew that there was problems in Washington State and in Florida and in Texas and other, in the Midwestern states. Shortly after we won the grape strike, as a matter of fact, probably within a day or two after we signed the grape contracts, my father was in Salinas leading a vegetable strike that ended up with a multi-year, I guess a couple of year lettuce boycott. There was a lot of pressure to go into different areas right away. His concern was that if we stayed in Delano, that we would do a disservice to, say, the apple workers in Washington State, or los limoneros from the Coachella Valley, or the lechugueros in the Salinas Valley. And so I think what he was looking for is a place that he could remove himself from the immediate problems and have a better overview, a more broad view of the realities out in the fields.
And what did he do when he came here? What did he meditate? Did he walk the hills? I mean, what kind of things did he do?
Well, you know, see, my dad was a very he was a very complicated person, and for folks that didn't know him, they might even think that there were some contradictions there. See, my father was a, you know, I know that after my father passed away, many people would ask me, you know, how would you, if you had to characterize your father in a couple of words, how would you do it? And you know, it's not an easy task to do that. But after thinking long and hard about it, a couple of things came to mind. I think first of all that the first thought that came to mind was that he was an idealist. And very spiritual. You know, when you talk about wanting to build a better world for farm workers, and knowing the odds that he was up against, you had to be somewhat of an idealist. He had a very strong, you know, his faith was rooted in his religion. And it was very important to him. I think that kept him centered and grounded. But also, he also knew that, you know, you got to do a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of practical things that have to be done. You know, he's had this one little saying, I think, that kind of encompasses those two aspects of him. He used to say, "Yeah, we're going to pray a little, and we're going to work a lot." And so I think my father was really a practical idealist. He was able to bring in those two ideals that, in many people's eyes, are contradictory, and he was able to mesh them. And produce a lot of good work from him.
But being here in La Paz, did La Paz mean something special to your dad as a place to contemplate and to think?
Well, just the name itself, La Paz, and the setting. Yeah, it was a place that you could come home, and you know, after being on the road for weeks and months on end, and the different fights and the turmoil of the time, he could come home, and it was a refuge for him. I know that it was a place that he could be with himself, and he could re-energize his spirit, recharge himself for the next fight. So yeah, it was a refuge from a real difficult and tough world.
What would he do when he was here? Would he garden? Would he go and walk in the hills?
Well, you know, first and foremost, he worked long hours. There's, you know, La Paz is the union's headquarters, and there was always meetings and planning sessions and talking to folks to launch new programs. In terms of how he relaxed, yeah, you know, he was a man of the earth. I mean, a farm worker, and I think that he found he was able to relax the most when he was able to go work with the earth, and so, but again, to show the practical side of him, right? He would do gardening not only as a form of relaxation, but he also wanted to experiment with some pesticide-free ways of farming. And so I remember we learned about the French intensive organic method of gardening, where you had to build the beds and go 2 feet down. And so the thing is that there was always a very practical side to him. So yes, he had to get some rest. And so by working with the land, he was able to forget some of the problems of the moment. But also he didn't just want to waste the time doing that. There was another goal there. Maybe we could find a more healthy and a more responsible way to farm.
30. Okay, let's change back. It's a good place to change. Yeah. So, because, you know, we haven't.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 154 and take number 2. We're now going to camera roll 155 and take number 3.
Rolling. This is take 3, marker. So when your father made the decision to come to La Paz, he took some heat. What was going on there?
Well, you know, there was people that thought that he was removing himself from the workers, right? And you know, my father was very practical, but also he was able to put things into terms that everybody could understand. I remember the one thing he said was, "Well, would you rather that, you know, that I move to Washington, where a lot of our other union friends are at?" He says, "No." He goes, "I want to be closer to the fields." So the thing is that you know, there was people that didn't understand that. But if you look at how he gave life to this movement, you know, my father was able to reach out and to bring in groups that could never work together. That if it wasn't for the union, they would be fighting. And he was able to go out and bring the better parts of everybody in different movements and groups and bring them together to work for a common cause. And so I think that a lot of our friends that thought that maybe La Paz wasn't the right setting to run a union from, you know, maybe they forget that you know, that the way my father approached this was like going to work in the morning. He used to say, you know, it's not just about marches, and we don't need a flash in the pan. He says, doing this work is like working in the fields. You get your row, and you get to work. When you're done, you get the next one. And so I think what he was saying, and I think what he did when he moved to La Paz, he was saying that I'm in this for the long haul. And so it doesn't do me any good to be a flash in the pan and to leave. I'm sure many of the folks that were critics of that have moved on. Well, I know they've moved on since then. My father knew he was going to be here for a long time, so he had to do something to recharge his inner spirit.
I remember talking to your father in about 84, 85, and I said, you know, asked him about long range. He says, like a boxer. I've been in the ring 80 times. I'm going to go in 81st time. Did he see this as long range?
You know, my father was... And see, I think, again, a lot of times people don't understand this. Of course, see, you know, I talked about, you know, how people asked me to characterize my father. Another characterization that I came up with that was also on the surface a contradiction in terms, but for me made a lot of sense, was that my father was the most impatient, patient man I'd ever been around. He was patient in the sense that he knew that this was a long-range fight, a long-term fight. He knew that there was going to be many setbacks and a couple of victories every now and then. He knew that it just took a lot of hard work. Nothing fancy, just a lot of hard work. And so he set himself for the long road. But on the other hand, he worked every day like it was his last day. He never had enough hours in a day to get his work done. So the thing is, he was able to balance the both. He knew that he would be here forever, but that it would be a shame to waste a minute in the day.
So, I guess with your father, if he worked that hard, I guess he didn't have regrets. Do you think he had regrets?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, my father was very Mexicano, right? And he didn't really, he kept everything close to his chest, right? I think some of the, so he never talked much about regrets. Of course, I mean, he talked about some tactical things that he wished he would have done differently. And I guess that on that end, we'll always be second guessing ourselves. But in terms of who he was as a man, you know, I think that the things that I did hear him talk about was that he was proud about how his family turned out, that a lot of us were still working full time, and the ones that weren't working full time, the women still found a lot of time to do volunteer work. So I think he was very happy about that, and I don't think there was any regrets there.
Now, in La Paz, you said that your father came back here to recharge and to work. Was he trying to build a community of people who were working together in for the union, or what was?
Well, you know, see that's the other thing of him. You know, a lot of our friends in labor approach things a little bit different than my father did, right? We're a union, but a little bit more than a union too. We're a movement. And I think that's something that's very important to all of us that continue to work in the union and in the farm worker movement. You know, the whole ideal of community was very important to him. He believed that people's lives are enriched when you work and live in community. And I know that was one of the things that were very important to him on a personal level. He thought that building community develops not only greater commitment, but it nourishes our soul. It was very important to him.
Okay. And do you think that he made, I mean, he was successful in building the community?
Well, if you asked him, he would say no, right? I know that on many occasions he went and we visited our friends in the Hutterite communities and we looked at cooperative movements and so I think that I know that he was very intrigued isn't the word. He was impressed with the work that Dorothy Day had done with the Catholic worker. The whole sense of sacrifice and service meant a lot to him, you know. So I think that in terms of building a community, he probably wasn't satisfied. But being able to immerse the whole concept of community with our labor work, he did a pretty good job.
Okay. What would you say would be
the greatest legacy of your father.
Boy.
And it could be personal.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a tough one, right? I mean, you know, the last 2 weeks we've been going out doing a lot of speaking and being at folks at park dedications and marches and misas and, you know, in my dad's memory. You know, I think that, I think what my dad's legacy is going to be, or what it is, I should say, is that, poor people, regardless of their color or the circumstances that they find themselves in, whether they're farm workers or poor whites in Appalachia, that if people work together and if there's a long-term commitment, that a lot of serious social change can be made. Let me put that statement into its historical perspective. You know, there was many attempts to organize farm workers. I mean, in the 30s, there was a lot of movements, and up and through 1962, when my father started, a lot of efforts to bring justice to the fields. I think what my father showed was that you know, you don't go out and make social change with the campaign. The way you make social change is by a lifelong commitment. Determination, sticking to it. And so I think what my father did was he showed that a regular guy, right? My father wasn't a fancy speaker. He wasn't, he was self-taught. Didn't have a lot of money. But with all those things against him, and those are things that many times we think are needed to have success in whatever you do, he showed that, no, that if you stick with it, and when you get knocked down, you get up and you dust yourself off, you say, okay, we're going to do it again. I think that his persistence, his perseverance, is an example to folks. So I think that's his legacy, is that if you work hard, and if you really dedicate yourself to making social change, si se puede, you can do it.
Anything else?
Okay, that's the end of take number three. Take four is next.
This is take four, Marker.
Well, could you tell me a story, or do you remember an incident that really illustrates that relationship between your dad and your mom?
You know, it was probably, Jesus. I was fortunate to come across one of my father's notebooks. Fred Ross, who my father learned a lot from, had taught my father that he should keep a daily journal. And he should write down, at the end of the day, just write down what he learned or what he hadn't learned or what was bothering him for the day. And I remember coming across a book with an entry. And I'm trying to remember, it was in 1967, like in February, maybe the early part of March. And I remember looking at it, I was thumbing through it because, you know, some of my father's thoughts were in there. And I remember there was an entry where my father said, it's very tough. I don't know if I can continue. That was it. And then, you know, I turned the pages and I saw a couple days later, another real simple entry. I spoke to Helen. I'm ready to go. That's the kind of strength that my mother gave my father.
And your father, in turn, gave your mother strength?
Yeah. You know, my mother, she's a woman of few words, right? See, she also grew up living in a barn. Not, you know, going to school without shoes and stuff. So, you know, a lot of times we talk about the ideological reasons for why we do our work, right? But I think to my mother and my father, it transcends any type of ideology. It goes down to a whole basic issue of right and wrong. You know, I remember I heard my father say once, he was asked, you know, why are you doing this, Caesar, right? And I think that the person who was interviewing was asking for like a, they were looking for, they were trying to pull out some type of political dogma or ideology, right? And my dad says, you know, let me see if I can explain it to you, right, in its most simplest sense. He talked about, you know, going to the eighth grade and having to stop going to school because he had to help put food on the table. And so he told the person that, I don't ever want to have another parent have to make the decisions that my parents made. That's why I'm doing this. And that's why I'm going to keep on doing this work also. Very basic.
Thank you. Well, it's a pretty simple talk.
Yeah. That's it. It's nothing fancy.
No.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 153. That was take 4 with the wild track at the end.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah.
Okay, this is room tone. Okay, that's the end of room tone and the end of the interview with Paul Chavez. Actually, it's the end of the sound roll too. Goodbye.